Hello, I'm Hillary McClure, Vice President of Multimedia Productions at Cybercrime Magazine. Welcome to Talking Cyber, a cybercrime radio segment where we discuss the latest news and breaking stories of the cyber economy, hackers, intrusions, privacy, security, and much more. Joining us today is Heather Engel, Managing Partner of Strategic Cyber Partners. Heather, welcome. So great to be speaking with you again.
Hi, Hillary. How are you doing?
I'm glad that we're on Talking Cyber. I always enjoy this series together. It's so much fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always fun to kind of do some analysis of the stories that are in the news and give a little bit of a look behind the scenes of what's really going on.
Let's jump into the first story that I'd like to discuss with you as I'm looking at the Cybercrime Wire, which is U.S. Nuclear Security Administration criticized by Watchdog over cybersecurity failures. And this was in The Record. And so quickly, just to level set, the U.S. agency that maintains and modernizes the country's nuclear stockpile was criticized by a government watchdog this week for lackluster cybersecurity policies that endangered both IT and operational technology networks. So I don't want to speak anymore. I'm going to pass it over to you. Take us through this story and what those failures are.
Sure. Well, so let's take a second and just kind of talk a little bit about operational technology, right? Most of us now are familiar with the Internet of Things, right? Like, this is the idea that we have smart refrigerators and we have things that can control our light bulbs and security systems in our home and things like that. Operational technology is a little bit different because it's been around typically for a really long time. And a lot of the systems that manage nuclear have been around since the 90s, maybe even the 80s and before. And so these systems, operational technology is just simply a manufacturing or a control system that has embedded software that, you know, controls these machines. These things can be really difficult to secure in today's threat environment because a lot of the time, you know, they've been around since most of these threats did not exist. And so what we're seeing here, the article specifically is calling out sort of a lack of some strategy documents. They're lacking an understanding of the cybersecurity posture and what the threats truly are to some of these operational systems. You know, this isn't something that I would say is uncommon. We see this a lot across not only government agencies, but other organizations that tend to have a lot of operational technology. And this is one of the things that it's sort of in the background, right? For most of us, we're comfortable and we're familiar and we know a little bit about what's happening with our PCs, but we don't have a great understanding, unless you work in these industries, of some of the systems that run, you know, supply chains that are critical infrastructure, you know, shipping, nuclear, things like that. And so that's really what this article is about.
Got it. Yeah, I definitely do not have a full understanding of what everything is, you know, what's going on with everything that goes into all of that. So that makes a lot of sense. But okay, it probably sounds very scary at first glance, but then when you get into it, I guess it sounds like it's a little more understandable, although still not the greatest.
Well, that's true. And, you know, one of the things that is difficult with operational technology is it tends to grow up over time, right? We'll add another system over here and it's connected to this first system that we had. And so very often you get to a point where you don't fully understand all the dependencies. So even if I have a patch available to patch a piece of software, if that breaks something in the whole chain, sometimes it can be very hard to determine what the actual problem was, right? Because we don't understand how this piece of equipment is running or has an impact on this other piece of equipment over here. And so it can be difficult. And, you know, obviously the recommendation here from the GAO, one of them is to implement a continuous monitoring strategy. And what that really means is very often organizations have been breached and they have no idea. And a continuous monitoring strategy just basically means if you can't secure the system to a specific standard, or, you know, let's say there's an exception in your infrastructure that won't allow you to meet regulatory requirements or security best practices, then you have to watch it more closely. That's really what continuous monitoring means. And that's one of the recommendations here and really across critical infrastructure, right? Anytime we're talking about operational technology, if you can't fully secure it or isolate it, then you have to monitor it and you have to watch it really closely.
Anything else you'd want to add? I mean, I feel like you did a really thorough job of that, but I always like to ask that question.
No, I think, you know, like I said, this isn't something that is really uncommon. It's something that we see across a lot of industries. Does this mean that everybody needs to be freaking out about, you know, the security levels? Well, no, but it definitely is something that needs to be addressed across a lot of different sectors. You know, this is not a problem that's unique to nuclear.
You're listening to Talking Cyber. I'm your host, Hillary McClure. Joining me today is Heather Engel, Managing Partner at Strategic Cyber Partners. Heather, the next story we're going to cover is titled, "The Crypto World is on Edge After a String of Hacks," and this was published in the New York Times. Hackers have terrorized the crypto industry for years. Certainly no new news there, but the recent rapid proliferation of DeFi startups has kind of given a new rise to a new type of threat, or maybe leveled it up, what have you. And, you know, they're loosely regulated ventures. They're allowing people to borrow, lend, and conduct transactions without banks or brokers or even credit checks, like all of that. So take us through this story and what the implications are for, I guess, the future of crypto and perhaps the future of DeFi, however that starts to develop further.
Yeah, well, just like with the last story, let's talk a little bit about what DeFi means. And DeFi just simply stands for decentralized finance. And what that means is it removes third parties and centralized institutions from financial transactions. So if you conduct business with Bank of America, right, there's a number of third parties in there. It's very heavily regulated. It's considered a centralized institution. It's supported and it's propped up by some of these institutions. DeFi, we don't see that. We've removed all of that. So there's benefits and there's drawbacks to it. And one of the drawbacks is that the industry itself isn't well regulated in terms of DeFi. And we all know that most of the time, technology far outpaces security regulations and requirements for doing things a certain way. We've talked before on this podcast about coding. And, you know, my opinion, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, is that coding is really an art form. It's not as black and white as everybody thinks. Yes, it's ones and zeros, and it's instructions that are telling your computer how to do things. But if I'm writing code, my code isn't going to look the same as something you write any more than, you know, if I'm in a high school English class and we're reading a book, we're all reading the same book and we're making, you know, an assessment of that book, but my essay is going to look very different than yours, right? So coding is really an art form. It's a language of expression. That means that it's not infallible. And very, very often, this is how we see a lot of data breaches. This is what a security patch is really for. It's fixing an error in the code that is an unintended consequence of the coder or the developer telling the computer to do something. And in this industry, it's so rapidly developing, and there are so many new companies that are popping up. There's new ideas, and everybody just wants to get that out there, right? They want to get started. They want to be, it's like the gold rush, right? We want to be first to the party so we don't get left behind. And what tends to happen now is there can be some really sloppy code out there. And, you know, that's not a reflection of this specific situation, but what we're seeing now is in DeFi, and when we're looking at some of these crypto companies that are starting up, they're having to really spend a lot of time and effort on evaluating the code and doing essentially penetration testing on the code to see if there are vulnerabilities that could be exploited for something like this. I mean, this article in particular is really fascinating. It talks about a company that completely went under. You know, their entire asset base was essentially stolen through a flaw in their code.
Certainly is going to be interesting observing the future of DeFi and everything that keeps happening there. And I'm sure this is just the beginning of what's to come, unfortunately.
Yeah, I likened it to the gold rush, and you'll see comparisons all over. I'm certainly not the first person to make this to crypto being kind of like the wild, wild west, right? And we want to get there. We want to be part of that initial rush, you know, to really stake and lay claim. But when we rush through things, you know, there has to be some security baked in, and very often that's not the case.
Absolutely, and I love that analogy. Certainly does feel like a digital gold rush.
Yeah.
You're listening to Talking Cyber. I'm your host, Hillary McClure. Joining me today is Heather Engel, Managing Partner at Strategic Cyber Partners. Heather, we just finished talking about the digital gold rush. And so let's move into this story about a Motley Fool stock pick hacker who's pleaded guilty to $3 million in fraud. And this story was published in Bloomberg. And an Idaho man who He worked as an IT professional. He admitted to making at least $3.5 million by illegally accessing the stock picks of the personal finance site, The Motley Fool, before they were released. So David Stone, he's pleaded guilty on September 23rd to securities fraud. But take us through further, you know, how did he go about this? Anything you know?
Yeah. So this is a story that was really interesting to me because I actually used to be a member of The Motley Fool's website, where they send you their stock picks and they talk about, you know, why that's a pick for them. And they tend to do very well. I mean, if you look at their portfolio performance, a lot of the stocks that I've invested in, you know, over the course of several years, based on some of their recommendations, have done really well. So the idea here is this is essentially insider trading just with a digital spin, right? So what this person did was he was able to access the stock picks before they were released. And what tends to happen is when The Motley Fool publishes these stock picks, immediately all the people who are members, like I used to be, will go out and they'll do some evaluation and they'll buy that stock. What was really interesting in the article is sometimes he really bet on options that almost no one, you know, would bet on. So he would bet on things like the stock price going up a certain percentage within the next 7 days or things like that. And so in this way, he was able to look at these stock picks before they were released, place some bets or purchase those stocks while they were still at a lower rate. And then when the stock pick was released to The Motley Fool's member base and the stock price went up just because of the sheer volume of trading and buys, you know, he was able to make money and then, you know, either hold on to it or cash out. It looks like he cashed out, you know, because he made a pretty significant amount of money by doing this.
Yeah, he definitely made a significant amount of money. I wonder what's up ahead for him. I don't know if he's going to have to do time or if he's just going to have to pay. I don't know what that process is.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, the article references he'll do some time in prison under federal sentencing guidelines plus a fine. And it says the fine could be anywhere from $20,000 to $5 million. But, you know, he made allegedly $3.5 million by accessing these picks. So you have to wonder, you know, how the judge will sentence based on, you know, the dollar amount that was made under that insider threat kind of trading.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting to follow this story. I'm just personally curious in it, so I will be following.
Yeah. And like I said, I used to be a member of The Motley Fool, and you know, I still, they have a lot of great content on their website. They, you know, they still, you can go out and you can read a lot of things for free. You don't have to be a member to use it for personal finance research and things like that. And so this was a really interesting one for me just because I had a little bit of personal experience with it.
Well, Heather, always so much fun speaking with you. Thank you for coming on and for talking cyber with me about these three stories for this week. I'm looking forward to the next time that we talk and whatever stories those will be. The future holds.
Yeah, it was great talking with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Heather. I'm Hillary McClure, Vice President of Multimedia Productions at Cybercrime Magazine. Talking Cyber is a Cybercrime Radio segment that discusses the latest news and breaking stories of the cyber economy, hackers, intrusions, privacy, security, and much more. To keep up with the latest security and privacy news updated daily, visit us at cybercrimewire.com.